So good evening. It's my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's program here at the World Affairs Council. As you know, I'm Jane Wales. I'm CEO of the Council, and the Council tries to provide a neutral forum for the discussion of global issues of significance. To learn more about our programs or to see the podcast of something you have not been able to participate in, our website is worldaffairs.org. I am going to ask you all to turn off your cell phones and other devices so that we can move into the program. And just note that we are taping this program for KQED, for It's Your World, our weekly radio program, and David Ogilvy is taping tonight. So thank you, David. What we will do is hear from Administrator Clark's, hear her remarks, and then we'll move to Q&A. And so I'd be grateful if you all would write down your questions on question cards in a really super legible way, and so I can take advantage of your good questions. It's now my honor to introduce tonight's guest. The Right Honorable Helen Clark has been Administrator of the United Nations Development Program since 2009. She's the first woman to hold that position and lead that organization. And not only does she lead the UN Development Program, she also chairs the UN Development Group. Prior to being named to UNDP, she served as the 37th Prime Minister of New Zealand, and you will recognize that in her accent. She's an advocate of cultural and social and political development, always was. And under her leadership in New Zealand, the country experienced very significant economic growth, low levels of unemployment, high levels of investment in education and in health, and the adoption of a comprehensive program for climate change. So please join me in welcoming the Right Honorable Helen Clark.
Well, thank you, Jane. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for the invitation to come to San Francisco. As we're walking from the hotel to here, Jane's assistant, Josh, said to me, have you been to San Francisco before? And I had to say, this is the first time I've ever spent a night here. I go through the airport quite often because it's a gateway to the South Pacific, and particularly New Zealand. Good to be here. And as I was walking in the city this afternoon, I saw the UN flag fluttering, which, of course, is a reminder that momentous events occurred here in 1945. And part of New Zealand's history is that the Prime Minister of the day, the Right Honourable Peter Fraser, came to San Francisco to the founding conference and played a hand in the drafting of the Charter, including opposition to the veto by the permanent powers, which has been a constraint on decision-making of the Security Council ever since. But that's a longer story. So good to be here. And I know you have a mini-series, a spotlight on development challenges. When I was written to about coming, it was also suggested that the Council was looking at this issue of what would our world look like in 2050. So I thought if we put that together, that we could have quite an interesting discussion. And certainly at the UN Development Programme, we're continually scanning that horizon. What are the big trends? What are the emerging issues and challenges? What are the drivers of change? How are we going to play a role supporting increasing human development within the boundaries that our planet sets? And I think it's a good time to be having this kind of discussion, because this is a year of major global events like RIO+20 in June, which I'll refer to as I go through, and also this major global debate and dialogue that's starting around how to refresh the global development agenda beyond 2015, which is the target date for the Millennium Development Goals. Where do we go from there? There's a debate raging out there with high-level panels and General Assembly discussion, and one certainly we'd want to hear voices from San Francisco on. So I gave the title of my talk tonight as Our World in 2050, More Equitable and Sustainable or Less? I guess the short answer is it's up to us, isn't it? But I will elaborate on that theme as I go through. But let me begin by putting 2050 into some perspective. It sounds far away, but actually it isn't. With around half the world's population today under the age of 30, and with current global life expectancy at almost 70 years, we can expect that half of all the people alive now are going to be alive in 2050. This is not some theoretical science fiction future we're talking about. Of course, even if 2050 weren't on our personal horizon, the responsibilities towards future generations of that time would not be any less compelling. And I refer to the definition of sustainable development developed by the Brundtland Commission of 1987. Sustainable development is about meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet those needs. And that definition has been very influential in the work of UNDP because it's based on a fundamental premise of justice, which is no one should be denied the ability or the opportunity to live a life they value because of any factor, could be gender, ethnicity, religious, whatever, and in this case, the generation in which they happen to be born. So, for that to be so, to pass on a world that offers no less than we are offered today, there is a need to act collectively rather differently if we are to achieve that future we want, which the Rio Plus 20 outcome document talks about. So, tonight I thought I would basically group my comments into three sections. First, have a look at what some of the global drivers of change are, which will impact on how the world may or may not look in 2050. Second, look at the linked themes of poverty, inequity, and environmental sustainability. And then wrap up by looking at how the global community and countries and the subnational level and individual actions are using approaches to address the challenges that we see. So, looking at some of the trends and projections, let me focus on just three. I mean, there are others and we could add to the list, but I wanted to focus on population dynamics, environmental constraints, and geopolitical shifts. On population, the forecasts are that we will number some 9.3 billion by 2050, some 2.3 billion more inhabitants on Earth than we have today, a trend which will be associated with rapid urbanisation and with ageing. And both of these are very important considerations for development planning. We're expecting the urban areas of our world to absorb about all of this population growth. Currently, more than half the world's population lives in urban areas. That is not consistent across regions, but is expected to be reached in Asia by 2020 and in Africa by 2035. So by 2050, the urban population will be almost double what it is today, up from 3.6 billion to 6.3 billion, and will make up over two-thirds of the world's total population. And most of that urban growth will be concentrated in developing countries. Now, then if we look at the aging dimension of that, by 2050, the proportion of the world's population, which is over 60 years of age, will double from the year 2000's 11% to 22%. And in 2050, for the first time in human history, the number of older persons aged over 60 will exceed the number of the young under 15. Now, there are both challenges and opportunities which arise out of these trends. Food supply obviously needs to be adequate for this large population. And speaking as a New Zealander, I can see the opportunities for the world's farmers and food processors. But to meet the demand, there will need to be considerable adaptation to the more extreme and volatile climatic conditions which are already affecting food production. Secondly, we can see that pension and social security systems are going to need to be fine-tuned to be affordable for those populations which live much longer and work later in life. Then there's the issue of the healthcare systems, which will need to cater for the needs of significantly more older persons and for the expected increases in the prevalence of non-communicable diseases. And these diseases, often thought of as a problem of developed countries, are of course now posing very significant challenges in developing countries as well. There was a high-level event at the General Assembly last year on the NCDs and development. It has been a neglected issue. Coping with these trends, the urban planning and urban governance systems will need to be updated to address dramatic increases in demands in cities for housing, jobs, electricity, water, health, education, transport, many services. And then there's the issue of social unrest, if we don't get it right. The drivers and triggers of social unrest, poverty, violence, extreme inequality, certainly need to be monitored and addressed. And then the final issue I raise is the issue of the demographic dividend, which can also cut both ways. Developing countries could experience a very significant and positive demographic dividend from their dynamic youth populations, but only if there is significant investment in the potential of young people and if jobs and opportunity creation for them become a specific and a very high priority of public policy, which we don't see universally today. So there's a long list of challenges and some opportunities. It's also true that demographic trends are largely predictable and they can be planned for, and they're not as contested as the next area I want to touch on, which relates to the environmental pressures on the planet. So let me be blunt that at UNDP we see climate change as a major challenge to development. The OECD estimates are that carbon emissions will more than double from 1990 levels by 2050, which will put rather hard-won development gains at risk and introduces a lot more complexity to our work as development actors. I think there is broad scientific agreement that without urgent action, the world will move beyond its planetary boundary on climate. And we have understood for some time from scientists that an increase in temperature of more than 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels, and 2 degrees Celsius, would lead to irreversible and catastrophic change. Now, 2 degrees is starting to seem like a very challenging figure. There was a major wake-up call in the study which came out from PricewaterhouseCoopers just in very recent days, and it is using pretty much the same projection as the International Energy Agency, saying that the world is on track for a 6 degree centigrade rise in temperatures by the end of this century. And that to avoid that, we would need annual greenhouse gas emissions cuts of 5.1% every year per unit of GDP, which, to put the scale of this challenge in perspective, is 6 times greater than the 0.8% average annual cuts achieved since 2000. I mean, this is a huge challenge. So if 2 degrees was catastrophic and irreversible, what does 6 do to our climate? Now, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is saying that increases in extreme weather are already a discernible trend. This is not just, you know, one extreme incident here or there, as we saw in New York and the Eastern Seaboard in the last week or so. It is a trend. And the impact of that is being felt on natural resources, on threatening food security and livelihoods, these much more frequent natural disasters from flooding to heat waves and droughts, and an increase in the incidence of natural resource-related conflicts both within and across borders. Now, from a development perspective, we have great concern that the people who are already the most disadvantaged in our world end up copping it again, because poor people disproportionately rely on access to natural resources for their livelihoods. And if we have that picture in our mind of the women and the girls in developing countries who generally bear the responsibility for collecting the fuel and the water, they face extra burdens as these resources become scarcer, they're further away from home, there's more time consumed in doing it, less time for income-generating activities, going to school, and the things which would contribute to a positive cycle of development. It's also worth observing that the growth of informal settlements in the cities of many countries has led to the creation of many more unstable living environments. And vulnerable and marginalized communities in those environments are impacted more from natural disasters because of this. I have in my mind the very vivid image of Port-au-Prince in Haiti, where the informal settlement neighborhoods are precariously perched down these very steep ravines, what we would call a gully in New Zealand. Now, these settlements, obviously, in many cases, were destabilized by the earthquake, but on a regular basis are threatened by this, by very extreme weather. And I climbed down to the bottom of one of these ravines down the stairway a few months ago, and you see the latest arrivals in the ravine basically at the bottom, and every time there's heavy rain, the water goes through their settlement. I mean, this is a very, very difficult existence indeed. So, with the expected rapid expansion of urban communities by mid-century, the challenge for our cities is going to be even greater. With the poor continuing to carry this double burden of exposure to environmental risks, both in their immediate home environment and from these longer-term global trends. Now, let me say a word about a sort of third driver of change we see from globalization and our connectedness to each other, and from the shifts in geopolitical dynamics and geoeconomic dynamics which are going on, and then the role of the non-state actors, which I think is extremely important. It's commonplace to say that we live in an era of unprecedented globalization and interdependence, where the impacts of policies, decisions, and initiatives in one place can ripple across the globe, which I suppose is one of many reasons why the entire world takes a great interest in what happened in America yesterday, because the decisions this country makes are so important in how our world moves forward. Now, 4 years ago, the crisis generated in the financial markets of the North spread to all corners of the earth because we're so interconnected, affecting the poorest and most distant nations, which experienced weaker demand and lower prices for their exports, higher volatilities in the capital flows and commodity prices, and lower remittances. I remember in September 2009 meeting with the president of Mozambique, and I said, "Mr. President, how is the global crisis impacting on your country?" And he said, "Well, our big export is aluminium. The volume is seriously down, and so is the price. The other inward flow of foreign exchange that we have has conventionally come from remittances, primarily from workers in South Africa, and that's dropped off as well because South Africa is so affected by the crisis. So even a very, very poor country like Mozambique, which is not particularly integrated, we could say, into the global economy, feels the repercussions because its one big export gets hit hard and the remittances that the families rely on get hit hard. Of course, the other side of globalization and interconnectedness is the benefit side in the form of new job opportunities and the spread of innovation and technology which can accelerate development. And it is rather inspiring to see in Africa how information and communications technologies have proliferated, more in some countries than others, but Kenya is a very interesting example of high uptake of these technologies, and seeing the way in which they bring services like mobile banking to people who no one ever had an interest in banking for before, is really very, very exciting. And there are countless other applications of these technologies too. Then there's the geopolitical shifts, as I said. And what have we witnessed? I guess in the last 20, 30 years, waves of democratization in Central and Eastern Europe following the end of the Cold War, in Latin America following the end of the era of the generals, in parts of Southeast Asia, and Myanmar is now coming onto that trajectory too, and in the Arab states region. We're seeing the emergence of these mega economies in the global south, with China, India, and Brazil already among the world's 10 largest economies. And in the development world, we're seeing tremendous dynamism in what we call South-South cooperation, cooperation across the South through technical assistance, grants, loans, trade, investment, knowledge sharing. In terms of grants, it's still a fraction of Western official development assistance, but it's dynamic and it's growing. Now, clearly, global public goods can't be secured and protected by nations acting alone. To deal with the kinds of threats and challenges we have, we need coordinated action, not only between countries, but also with these very important non-state actors across the private sector, which is increasingly interested at a global level in development, civil society, and the mega philanthropic foundations, and there are many associated with this country. And I think the role of the non-state actors in development and discourse about it can only grow. Interesting to reflect that when people drafted the UN Charter in San Francisco, they started with the words, "we the peoples." Never said "we the nation states," "we the member states." It was "we the peoples." And I think the UN is now scrambling to catch up with how you relate to the peoples and not only to the governments. The civil society relationships are very important. So, moving ahead from talking around some of these trends then to some of the projections. And I guess my key point here is that whether the world is more or less equitable and sustainable by 2050 will depend on the policy choices that we make at the global level, national level, organizational level, company level, society, individual level. UNDP every year publishes a global human development report. And last year we did it on what we saw as the linked themes of equity and sustainability. And we looked at precisely the future in 2050 and what it could be if you factored in different weightings around trends in equality, inequality, environmental sustainability, unsustainability. There were three scenarios constructed. The first, the base case scenario, and actually the best case scenario, assumed only limited changes in inequality and environmental threats and risks. And on the basis of that, anticipated that global human development index could be around 19% higher in 2050 than it is now, which would represent a rate of progress in lifting human development similar to that achieved between 1990 and 2010. And the big winners from that would be sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. But the central message of the report was that this scenario was unlikely to materialize unless bold steps are taken now to avert future environmental catastrophe. Think back to my 6 degrees centigrade global warming scenario from PricewaterhouseCoopers. And unless we begin to reduce deep inequalities within and between nations. So then there were two other scenarios, kind of base case through to worst case. The middle case, the environmental challenges scenario, took into account the impact of global warming on agricultural production, challenges around supply of water, sanitation and pollution, and growing inequality and its consequences, and came up with a rather slower rate of increase for the global human development index at around 8 percentage points lower than the base case and 12 percentage points lower for sub-Saharan Africa. However, the more adverse environmental disaster scenario, which I often think is probably the most realistic right now, if nothing changes, amplified the magnitude of the impacts modelled and came up with a projection of the Global Human Development Index moving 15 percentage points below the base case scenario in 2050, with the most savage impact of that on sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, and seeing human development progress in those regions actually regress, not just slow to a crawl, but regress, which is obviously extremely concerning. So out of this, we took the message that to maintain and accelerate human development progress, we have to tackle inequality and unsustainability together, that these are linked challenges. And this is very much the focus that came out of RioPlus 20. The outcome document concluded that sustainable development is the only viable path for development. It highlights how environmental protection and economic development are linked, and for the first time at a global conference of this kind, it gave equal emphasis to the social dimension of sustainable development, which is extremely important. Now, prior to Rio, the Secretary General had set up a panel on global sustainability, and it released a report, Resilient People, Resilient Planet, earlier this year, suggesting that most economic decision makers still regard sustainable development as extraneous to their core responsibilities. In other words, it just hasn't been top of the priorities. And yet, if we're looking at these trends, clearly things have to be done differently. And the longer you delay action, the more difficult it becomes to get to good results. When you think of that projection, again, of PricewaterhouseCoopers, that we would need to have a rate of reduction of greenhouse gas emissions six times what we've achieved basically in the last decade, it becomes very, very, very difficult. On inequality and development, well, I think sometimes when we see debates around inequality in society, as in the recent Occupy movements, they're often framed or reported on as being essentially ideological debates and not relevant to development outcomes. That, I think, is very much contested now. And there's quite an interesting growing literature on how more equal societies actually do better on most aspects of human well-being, and that those benefits are accrued not only by the poorest, but also by all segments of society. And I guess the Scandinavian societies are the best exemplars of that. In essence, and we have published on this theme at UNDP, we see more unequal societies where levels of trust and social cohesion are low, being less likely to invest in public goods and infrastructure, the kinds of investments which are so critical for the well-being of current and future generations. Joe Stiglitz had a wonderful phrase that growing inequality is the flip side of something else, which is shrinking opportunity. And that is a problem in Western societies as in developing societies. So as we think about this global development agenda post-2015, obviously our advocacy at UNDP is very much around elevating attention to tackling inequality and environmental sustainability together if we are truly to have this future that we want, which RioPlus 20 spoke about. Now, sometimes one asks oneself the question, if things are so challenging, why don't people act? And I think it comes back to policymakers and decision makers really often facing very short-term horizons. I mean, I've been in politics virtually all my life. Our political cycle was 3 years, not four. So every 3 years, you faced another general election. And it's very easy to slip into the shorter term thinking that goes with short-term cycles. But there are ways of overcoming electoral cycles and setting out a longer-term vision of where you want to take a country, the steps you can take in 3 years, the next three, and so on. But it needs very, very deliberate strategies. And I would hope that the work the UN does to try and build consensus and, you know, purvey information about these big issues can help countries begin to take that longer-term perspective about what needs to be done. This was certainly done with the Millennium Development Goals, which are probably the most successful branded initiative the UN has had in a very, very long time, setting common goals in development around a medium-term horizon. And now Rio Plus 20 really challenges us to take that to new levels, not just in the UN, but in member states as well. And there are a number of initiatives very much discussed at Rio, like sustainable energy for all, big initiative from the Secretary General, the Zero Hunger Challenge, which he has issued, initiatives which are trying to focus global attention on pressing challenges of our time. Now, at the national level, I think it is extremely important to be building capacity for and awareness of the need for more integrated decision making, so that we consciously make decisions which are endeavouring to advance living standards and equality and environmental protection at the same time. But this requires some sophistication in governance and decision-making systems. We have been doing some rather interesting work in UNDP with countries to support planning for low-carbon, climate-resilient, inclusive green economy strategies. It sounds like a lot of platitudes in one phrase, but believe me, when poor countries like Ethiopia pronounce that that's what they want, the future they want is a low-carbon, climate-resilient, green economy, they mean it. They want their people's living standards to come up, but they want to do it in a way which is going to be consistent with maintaining nature's balance. So part of our contribution has been not only to the design of some of these strategies and the flow-on action plans, but also to document them, talk about them. And we've published on triple wins for sustainable development, highlighting very, very interesting case studies of significant national initiatives which both raise living standards and promote equality, including for women, and are good for the environment. And there's a great deal that can be said about that. Now, international agreements and governments can do a certain amount, but unless you have engaged citizens who care about these things and keep the pressure on, of course, governments don't feel under so much pressure to act. I think the real achievement of Rio Plus 20 was not the consensus achieved among the member states. Let's be frank, that was at rather a low level of consensus. The excitement of Rio was the mobilization of global opinion. The people who came representing the civil society organizations, indigenous communities, the major international NGOs, the subnational governments, and there's a lot of exciting work at state and municipal level done in this country, including right here in this state, the private companies prepared to make commitments. This was where the energy was, and we're seeing these pragmatic, multi-sectoral coalitions now around issues. I think that's exciting, and I think there is a groundswell for change out there. I think there's a very important role for the mega philanthropic foundations in building these partnerships. Venture philanthropy, if I could call it that, can certainly spur innovations and solutions around inequality and sustainability, which can then be adopted and scaled up by local communities. So, to come to a conclusion, I've endeavoured tonight to canvass broadly some of those drivers of change, the demographic, environmental, geopolitical, and some of the things we could do to ensure that the world is more equitable and sustainable, not less, in 2050. Of course, understanding the trends and applying sophisticated modelling can help us plan for the future. But ultimately, we need political will and leadership on these issues. And we need a good, strong push from the societies for that to happen. We do see successful examples of action for sustainability from every corner of the world, and I'm very conscious that I'm speaking here in the Bay Area, which is known as a centre of innovation and social entrepreneurship, and as a community which respects diversity of peoples and protects its environment. There's a lot to share out of California. And I certainly hope that San Francisco, birthplace of the United Nations, and an outward-looking city, an innovation hub, will very much be part of this discussion on how do we make the future we want, as defined by Rio. What should the global development agenda going forward from 2015 be to try and shape a better future for 2050 than some of the trends suggest it could be if we don't act? Thank you.
Thank you so much. Not surprisingly, we have several questions that key off the elections that we just had, presidential elections we just had. And one of the there are two key themes. One is what does one do, to what do you attribute the short-termism that is within the political system but also within the electorate? And how does one overcome that? And the second large question that fell in this category spoke to an issue you highlighted, and that's climate change. Questioners have asked such things as, explain to us the politics of climate change. This questioner notes that climate change was largely missing from the recent presidential debates. And asking whether you are seeing the emergence of a new consciousness or a new willingness to shunt hard issues aside.
I think the short-termism relates to these short electoral cycles. I mean, I referred to our three-year one in New Zealand, which I like to think we worked hard to overcome, but there is a reality. If you want to keep governing, you have to put your case every 3 years. And some of these big issues tend to slip down the agenda in that context because they require longer-term focus. In this country, every 2 years, your House of Reps, people are up for election. Very hard to think long-term, isn't it? Because you're making those phone calls every day to raise money for the next election, which is coming down the track. Yeah, so I think it's around the political cycle. And then there's that calculation of are there votes in it? And I guess the brutal truth is there haven't been seen to be votes in acting on climate change in this country, or it would have had a much higher priority. However, I think now the cumulative impact of some of these really shocking weather events, it has the prospect of changing this. No one wants to comment on this in the immediate aftermath of Sandy, because there's still people in desperate and dire need and hardship. But I think minds are turning to, well, what does this mean? What does this mean for how we live? What does it mean for how we adapt? What are the costs of this going to be? And I hope that out of it will come a reflection on what priority can be given in the US now to these issues. And I think with the second term, there's a chance. But I stress again, it needs a push from below. It needs a push from the community. I saw a rather interesting comment in the aftermath of Rio, where the international NGOs were very critical of the consensus reached by member states at Rio. And I understand that. It wasn't a high level of consensus. But someone made the comment, maybe a lot of the advocacy of exactly such NGOs is very much being geared at an elite level, and we've forgotten how to mobilise and organise at a community level to really get a push from below. And my plea really is for the world's peoples to push from below, put the pressure on leaders to act on these issues. We've seen mass movements come and go before around very important causes. Why not this one? And I think the awareness of the need to act will grow. if only because we see so many affected by these terrible problems.
And do you see you seem to be speaking right now to breaking an international deadlock, in essence, and through an international process. Do you see OECD countries lagging behind in the sense that they are immediately concerned about their fiscal crises or their the economic crisis in Europe as well?
Well, there's a couple of points to make on that. Firstly, times are tough. Times are tough here. Times are tough in Japan. Times are tough in a great deal of Europe. So when times are tough, it's tempting to see issues like a transition to a green economy as somehow a luxury to be debated. But actually, you could turn that round and see that transition as in itself helpful for longer term and sustainable recovery. Because if you commit to that transition, it will spur investment, it will spur innovation, it will create new jobs, products, technologies, services. It can be part of the answer to the economic doldrums as well as to the environmental crises we face. So I think it's important to advocate for seeing that solution. Now, the second point to make is that the European Union has been quite a standard bearer, I think, on some of these issues. Not without tension internally. There is some spectre of opinion between newer member states in Central and Eastern Europe on these issues versus the Western European nations. But what is very clear is that on climate change, for example, heroic emissions reduction by Western countries alone won't solve the problem. It needs action much faster in the emerging economies as well. And now the talks on this get bogged down over common but differentiated responsibility. And the principle is that the developed countries which have contributed so much to the carbon stock that the world now faces should make the biggest moves. I agree with that. It doesn't mean others don't have to do anything. Others have to also commit to a different path. Now then, you come to the issue of money, and it's interesting how often problems are solved by money. So money's put on the table for adaptation and mitigation. Yes, we will get more action. But of course, we're asking for money to be put on the table at the very time that the traditional donors are most hard-pressed. So that's a conundrum as well. There's another climate change conference of parties in Doha in the next few weeks, which I will go to. And really, we need to see more of the colour of countries' money on the Green Climate Fund. There was a commitment by developed countries at a previous conference of parties to $100 billion per annum, extra and additional finance for climate change adaptation and mitigation by 2020. We're not seeing anything remotely like that at the moment. And so it is going to be harder to get the commitment to move from developing countries unless there's more movement there from the developed ones.
Of course, we want developing countries to have the energy they need.
Yes.
What role will shale gas play in that equation? I know we want to get away from fossil fuels, but what does this new availability do to that equation and that thinking?
Yeah, I don't pretend to any expertise on that. I mean, I must say my own preference would be to see very, very heavy investment in the renewable technologies, the solar, the wind, the battery power, the tidal, the hydro, et cetera. That's where I think the longest term benefits are. I can see countries looking to the prospect of the shale gas as a way through. But
and you are back to that short-term long-term dichotomy.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about the emerging economies. You've got countries like China and India, Turkey, Nigeria, South Africa, Chile, Brazil. I mean, countries all around the world that are experiencing extraordinary economic growth. That growth is not always broad-based. It isn't always resulting in inclusive development. But what is it that they're doing right? What's this magic? What is the magic formula that is bringing that new wealth and offering an opportunity for inclusive development if it's that path is chosen?
Well, the growth's coming off a lower base, obviously, of total income than in our own countries. So, you know, the kinds of growth rates that you will see in China, it's slow at 7.5%, isn't it? And they really need 9% to keep up with the needs of their population. But China, if it's in the top 100 GDP per capita countries, it would only just have moved into it. I mean, this is still, relatively speaking, a poor country. So the growth is rapid off the low base. And in a developed country, in New Zealand, when I was Prime Minister, we ran at 3.5 to 4% growth, and you can't really grow more than that as a developed country. It's just not in the DNA. But from a low base with a lot of infrastructure to develop and schools to construct and so on, in a developing country, you can. Now, you raise the important issue: is this growth equitable? Well, the truth is only if there's deliberate policy that makes it so. And let's celebrate the success of Brazil, where particularly under Lula, there were very determined efforts to really focus on the entrenched poverty and inequality in Brazil, which has been measured as one of the least equal societies in the world. He was determined to change that. And there has been a process of change, particularly around cash transfers and extensive social protection systems. So you can make a difference, but it's got to be deliberate policy. In China, it's interesting to see the debate now as China goes through its 10-year leadership transition. What are the problems the new leaders are going to have to deal with? Well, one of them is inequality. And one of the issues that China engaged UNDP in support for was looking precisely at strategies as to how to deal with growing inequality, because they see that obviously as generating instability, which, you know, long term has significant consequences. We advocate for countries to look at how to make their growth strategies inclusive. I'm not myself dismissive of growth that's generated off extractive industries. I see my near neighbour, Australia, got very rich off extractive industries. So did Canada, so is Norway. But you have to use that wealth to make a difference to your people. And a lot of the growth we've seen in Africa, that wealth hasn't been used for those purposes. It hasn't been used to be invested back into a virtuous cycle of development, education, health, infrastructure, jobs, opportunities, and so on. You need public policy for that. Now, I think, you know, hopefully we've gone through the era where the state and public policy was thought, you know, to be old school. It's absolutely critical to creating the equitable and sustainable societies of the future.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you bring up Brazil, because there's a case where there had been a high degree of tolerance for inequality, and so a normative shift had to happen. Yeah. Where you say, I'm going to reject something I have just seen as a fact of life. Mm. And then, of course, China, there's very low tolerance for inequality, and so this worry about instability, political instability. This questioner asks what role you see by non-OECD countries, donors like China, like India, playing a development role internationally, globally?
Well, the role they're playing is growing rather fast, as I said, although in terms of actual grants, as official development assistance essentially is, it's still a small proportion of the total. Now, There is a great desire in the OECD to engage the major South-South players in more of a global dialogue about development cooperation. The South-South players are kind of standing a little aside from this and saying, well, of course we're interested in what you're doing, but we have our own model and, you know, ways of doing it. There was a major conference in Korea late last year, the Busan Conference, which really officially changed the jargon from talking about aid effectiveness to development effectiveness, not only because the reality is that aid is only a small factor in driving overall development, but also to try and engage these other partners in a global conversation about what makes for effective development. But where we sit in the UN, we still see very much two paradigms. We see the OECD DAC paradigm, and it's trying to talk to this other paradigm, but it can be a bit of a one-way conversation at the moment. But what we also see is a number of the big players in the South-South cooperation wanting to work with us in setting up their development cooperation programs and trying to get some order in the national development cooperation effort. If you take, for example, Brazil, only a small portion of that country's South-South cooperation would go through its nascent development cooperation agency. A lot is going out through all sorts of other arms of the state, and they're trying to bring some order to that. So, you know, we can help in some of those ways.
I have a series of questions here about the role of women on both sides of the equation. This questioner asks whether you believe that the advent of more women in political power, but also with economic power, making a difference in leading us to more long-term thinking, more commitment to an equitable and sustainable point of view. Mm-hmm. And other questioners note that that women represent 60% of the world's poor. They're also producing 60% of the world's work. Why aren't they reaping the benefits, and what role can UNDP play in changing that reality?
Yeah. Well, our basic position is that, you know, women's full representation at every level of decision making and in economic sectors is, you know, is a good thing in itself. I mean, it's a basic right to be equally represented. But as Hillary Clinton has often said, it's smart economics as well. If a society isn't drawing on all its talent across the community, it's going to sell itself short. And probably the most effective investments you could make in achieving the Millennium Development Goals would be the investments you make in women and girls, education, opportunities, reform of laws and status laws and regulations, which don't treat women equally. So we see it as extremely important for countries to reach their full potential. And for us, the package is political empowerment, economic empowerment, and legal status and rights becoming equal.
When you think about the MDGs, virtually all of them required an investment in women and girls,
yes,
or the success of women and girls. What do you attribute the resistance of one goal of maternal health, maternal mortality, resistance to any poverty, real progress in that? What has made this such a hard problem?
I think it speaks volumes about the low status of women in many societies, where services for them have not been a priority. We're so far away from universal access to sexual and reproductive health services. I go to a lot of countries where, you know, there are surveys of whether needs are being met in this respect, and it's quite common to see 30% saying, look, we'd like to access these services, but we can't get near them. They're just not there, or they're too far away. You can't get the transport to them. There's also the fact that you can have the service, but if a woman doesn't have the status and power in her family to walk out the door and access it, well, the service might as well be 1,000 miles away as down the road. So, you know, I think there's fundamental issues here about the lack of status and lack of equal rights and power of women, and we need to be addressing that very, very consciously. I do think that Hillary Clinton at State Department has been a marvelous advocate on this. I think she's really brought a sort of lot of soft power, if you like, from the US and behind these issues. And the woman PM in Australia, Julia Gillard, went to the Pacific Island Forum just a few weeks ago and announced a very big initiative from Australia around lifting the status of women in the Pacific. So good to see the women leaders really, you know, pushing these issues now.
Food security was an issue you touched on, given demographic trends. Mm-hmm. We have questions about about technology when it comes to the production of food and sort of nutritious calories, mm-hmm. and what role genetically modified GMOs will likely play, and whether we should be concerned about that.
Oh, well, brings back memories of debates in New Zealand, where it was a very hot issue in the first general election that I won as Prime Minister, and we said as an opposition, look, we don't have the skills and resources and knowledge to come to a firm opinion on this, so we will set up a Royal Commission of Inquiry into genetically modified organisms. And the result was, I think, the world's only comprehensive Royal Commission of Inquiry into genetically modified organisms. It can be downloaded from the internet. And it was well-researched, and in essence, the approach it advocated, which we adopted, was to take a precautionary approach, you know, but to be guided by the science, by the evidence, and so on. Now, of course, the net effect of all that was that there was very little investment in such research in New Zealand, and probably not much more than a few squares of trials of potatoes, which activists regularly dug up around scientific research stations. So it didn't progress very far in what is one of the most, you know, innovative agricultural producing economies in the world. Mm. So that might tell you something about where I'm coming from. I think answers can be found to food security without necessarily going down that track, but they will relate partly to adaptation to this more extreme climate that we face. And also, you know, maybe we need to look at some more fundamental issues. I mean, is it not the case that our world has roughly a billion people who go to bed hungry every night and a billion people who are obese? We waste a tremendous amount of food, not only in advanced societies, but in poor countries, the proportion of food produced, which actually rots where it is because of lack of infrastructure, storage, distribution systems and so on, is quite significant. We're talking probably 30 to 40% of it. So... You know, there's a lot of things we can do to ensure food security, which are fairly basic on the basis of what we know now and what's acceptable now.
I'm going to try to squeeze in rapid fire three different questions. The first speaks to the role of enterprise and asks, what role does enterprise play in the development agenda and in development programs? So it's commercial enterprise and social enterprise. Yep. What do they play?
As I said, we're seeing increasing and intense interest in the major companies in development. Now, from our perspective at UNDP, we welcome this. We welcome the partnerships. We work to take them far beyond traditional notions of corporate social responsibility. What we are interested in is the creation of opportunities and value chains for poor people in poor countries. So how do you support the small producer to access a value chain, whatever the small product is? It might be a smallholder agriculture in a place where there's destination tourism, whatever. But that's our interest. So, you know, as I say, welcome the attention and have, I think, good models to offer companies who are interested in contributing to more inclusive ways of developing.
And in so doing, they can seed smaller enterprises by sourcing locally.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, several of the questioners ask about the way in which we measure progress and economic development, and you spoke to it in your remarks. I mean, GDP is an average, so it doesn't tell you anything about equality or inequality. Mm-hmm. Human Development Index was a controversial thing when it was first introduced, mm-hmm. when Bill Draper had that job. Tell me what we have learned about how we should be measuring economic development.
Well, I mean, the beyond GDP debate is alive and well. I think UNDP pioneered, you know, the broader index, which brought in the education and health factors alongside income. And now there's this issue of how we bring in a sustainability dimension to reflect the spirit of Rio. Of course, we can't entirely dismiss GDP. I mean, the amount of money you have is not irrelevant to the the life you enjoy. But as you say, the averages don't tell us anything much about the distribution of the wealth, which is why I think some of the more useful work we've done is in producing these equality-adjusted HDIs, gender equality-adjusted HDIs, which give societies and decision-makers then some insights into how, if they dealt with the inequalities which exist, they could, you know, boost overall the human development status of their country.
I'm going to just take you quickly to the question of big data, which has been on the minds of three different questions on big data, which is interesting. And the World Bank, in fact, just began to release massive amounts of data that they gather. UNDP gathers an extraordinary amount of information on what works, what doesn't in the development world. How might that data become more available in real time to other actors, who, such as philanthropic actors, who want to make sure that their interventions are well-timed and smart?
Mm. Well, I think the World Bank, you know, it was a great move to put everything out there. And we've also moved to put everything out there with the decision I pushed at our board, which it eventually took, to put everything we do on the internet, all our internal audit reports, evaluation, the lot, it's all there. Anyone who wants it can have it. We have nothing to hide. We're a publicly accountable, multilateral organisation. Our shareholders are the world's people, if you like. We have to be, you know, totally transparent. So it's all there. Whatever you want, use it. This is our message.
But what I probably should add, though, I mean, UNDP has been extraordinarily forthcoming for a very long time. What I probably should add is that one of the issues that's developing in this field is, do we use the same language? Do we even use the, you know, and how do you make it so that these various databases are interoperable? But I'm now getting really boring, so I won't take you further down that.
Well, sometimes we use the same language, but we mean different things.
That's right.
So it has to be decoded.
So I have a question that relates to the priority that the UN places on development issues, and another that relates to your... Well, let me just start with that one. The questioner asked, how many people report to the UN General Secretary? And so where is UNDP in that line? And how are your and other development agencies, how do they fit in that larger order?
Well, we don't report to the Secretary General. We have a board. You know, the UN has these three areas of mandate: peace and security, human rights, and development. So we're in the development pillar. It's quite a complex pillar. UNDP is what is known as a fund and program with its own board elected from the member states. So it has a subset of the member states, probably roughly a fifth of them on the board. UNICEF, similarly. UN Population Fund has the same board as we do. And so on. Now, there are other parts of the system, like UNEP, where there's more control from the Secretariat, even to the extent of appointments, UNCTAD, et cetera. You've got the whole bunch of specialised agencies, International Labour Organization, WHO, the FAO, UNESCO, et cetera, where they have their own boards and really have quite an independent existence. What differentiates them from, say, UNDP is that we are still kind of covered by the mandates from the General Assembly. And one of the big events in our life this year is the General Assembly does a review of the what it calls the UN's operational activities for development. And it's doing that review right now. It will produce a resolution which sort of gives the framework, if you like, within which we act. But in essence, our main accountability is to our board and, of course, to our funders. Because if the funders aren't happy, you can't do anything because you haven't got the money. And then there's an accountability to the countries in which we work. We need to be responsive and accountable for doing a good job to them as well. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of accountabilities when I think about it.
So when, unfortunately, we've come to the end, but let me just note three questions that I didn't get to ask so that when you come up and you speak to our speaker, you can ask these. One was, what will be the follow-on to the Millennium Development Goals? The second is, will climate change be included in the new round, for it wasn't in the first? And then finally, what will the role be of the poor in setting that agenda? So we have a really great excuse to invite you back, Administrator Clark, back, and to respond to that set of questions. And please join me in thanking Administrator Clark.